Kristen Carter. My debut contemporary pop album, Full Bloom, is now yours to discover. Full Bloom is a living garden of 12 songs that celebrates the beauty and the seasonal nature of life. You can find Full Bloom wherever you listen to music. Visit thekristencarter.com or follow at Kristen Carter Music for more. Funded by Factor and Canada's private radio broadcasters.
Legendary Barris Hammond returns Saturday, July 27th, inside L'Olympia Concert Hall, downtown Montreal. This is an early evening show, so bring your mother, auntie, sister, and granny. We're all going to see Uncle Barris. Doors open at 6:30 p.m. Early bird tickets on sale now at BarrisHammondMontreal.com. Barris Hammond, Saturday, July 27th, live in Montreal.
La chanteuse québécoise Andrea Superstine est l'une des voix les plus polyvalentes de la musique d'aujourd'hui. Son nouvel album, Oh Mother, est un ambitieux tour de force qui met en lumière sa créativité et sa sensibilité croissante en tant qu'auteure-compositrice. Can you hear me calling out your name? Oh Mother est disponible dès maintenant et Andrea se produira au Upstairs Jazz Club de Montréal le vendredi 3 mai. Pour plus d'informations sur le spectacle, visitez le site upstairsjazz.com.
Are you a tenant in Montreal? Do you have questions about your rights? Your local housing committee can help. To find the housing committee for your neighborhood or for more resources, go to www.rclalq.qc.ca.
Rehabilitation.
I wonder if you know what the word means. Do you? It comes from the Latin root habilis. The definition is to invest again with dignity. You consider that part of your job, Harvey, to give a man back the dignity he once had? Your only interest is in how he behaves. you'll conform to our ideas of how you should behave.
I am not a number. I am a free man.
You were a number. You weren't a man. You want to be a human. I wasn't Jim Crow, and hell, I was number 586.
Why do you do a warder's job?
It's a good job. Responsible job. Officers like myself trying to...
Scum.
We're only enforcing the law.
The law. When they hang my husband, is that just...
You're listening to the Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM. I'm Virginia, and I'll be your host for today. Today, we will be sharing audio from an event that happened in Montreal on May 4th, 2024. The event was a book launch for the book How to Abolish Prisons, Lessons from the Movement Against Imprisonment by Justin Pichet and Rachel Herzing. It took place at Articule. In this first section, we will hear introductions of all the panelists and the first question from the moderator.
How to Abolish Prisons is based on interviews across Turtle Island with organizers, and it looks to the practical and everyday ways people organize to resist the violence of the settler colonial carceral system. And the book is also amazing. So Rachel, Justin, Wendy, Chris, Josh, and Donnie, I'm looking forward to hearing you all. So thanks for being here, and I'm going to pass over the mic.
Hey, merci beaucoup, Sheena, and thanks to everyone who had a part in organizing this event. I guess my role tonight is to facilitate a discussion about the book, but also about resistance and working towards decarceral futures. So my name is Justin Pichet, co-author of How to Abolish Prisons, Lessons from the Movement Against Imprisonment, full-profit criminology at the University of Ottawa, been a co-editor of the Journal of Prisoners on Prisons since 2008, and been involved in campaigns to stop prison construction. So been involved in, for instance, a campaign to stop a billion-dollar jail from being built in Ottawa, which we won, but that turned into the announcement of several smaller prisons in so-called Eastern Ontario. We're fighting against that, namely against the 235-bed new prison the Ford government wants to build in Kempville on the grounds of the former Kempville Agricultural College, which includes 178 acres of prime agricultural land. You know, we live in a context of food insecurity, so they want to pave over that. They want to pave over Rideau River Watershed Creek that has fish and tons of other, actually some species at risk, according to the environmental assessment that are in there, and floodplain. So building on floodplain in an age of climate catastrophe. Sounds like a great idea, you know, and as Sheena's mentioned, imprisonment is deeply connected to the land and how we use it, how it gets exploited for the purposes of capitalist accumulation. When the college dropped out of the town, the government comes up with magical solutions to reactivate that surplus land and that stolen land, and they want to build a prison there. And we're going to stop them. That's how it is. Today, we have with us, and I'm doing the bios, so co-author of the book, Rachel Herzing. For those who aren't familiar with Rachel, Rachel is an organizer, activist, and advocate fighting the violence of surveillance, policing, and imprisonment. And she's done this work for over two decades. Rachel was executive director of the Center for Political Education, a resource for political organizations on the left and progressive social movements, was co-director of Critical Resistance, national organization dedicated to abolishing the prison industrial complex in the so-called United States, and director of research and training at Creative Interventions, a community resource that developed interventions to respond to interpersonal harm that don't rely on policing, imprisonment, and traditional social services. So that's a bit about Rachel, and Rachel joined the launch in Ottawa and here in Montreal via New York City. Next to Rachel, we have Wendy Barreto of European Mohawk descent. Wendy has a deep interest in understanding the carceral system, fighting it, especially regarding institutions designated for women. She served on the board for the West Coast Prison Legal Services, volunteered for the BCCLA, is involved in Joint Effort Collective, grassroots support group. Additionally, she participates in organizing public education events, including for Montreal Prisoner Justice Day Committee and the Vancouver Prison Justice Network. Her background includes Gladue report writing, paralegal diploma, ongoing studies for fundraising through George Brown College, and most recently worked for the Canadian Association of E-Fry Societies and is in the progress of establishing an organization to provide services to individuals incarcerated at Joliet Institution. We also have Donnie Armstrong, who actually participated in the virtual launch of this book. It was the first event connected to this book, so grateful for you to join us again. From the Termite Collective, which is a group of concerned and creative folks who want to expose the increasingly repressive nature of prison through writing, workshops, political parody, and criminal cabaret. Some of us are currently incarcerated, out on parole, and or in a variety of ways wandering in this place. So thank you all for joining us, and thank you for the good work that you've done with the exhibit with Melissa and Sasha and everyone else who was involved. We also have from Prisoner Correspondence Project, Chris Lee and Josh Pavin. For those that don't know, PCP is a solidarity project for gay, lesbian, transsexual, transgender, gender variant, two-spirit, intersex, bisexual, and queer prisoners in Canada and the United States, linking them with people a part of these same communities outside of prison. So they'll all be talking about their work today. Okay, so this one's going to start with Rachel. We're going to start with the book, and then we'll move out from there, okay? So, Rachel, why did we write the book, and what do we cover in the book?
All right. Good evening, everybody. Thank you so much for having me. I'm very, very grateful to be a guest on this land and very grateful for everybody who put labor into this event tonight. And I'm a little envious, Donnie, that you're sitting there and we're sitting up here because this is awkward. We wrote the book as a bit of an intervention in the friendliest way. We were thinking at the time that we began thinking about the book, which was 2015, almost 10 years ago, that there were like incremental, tiny, like inroads into mainstreaming the idea of abolition, whether that was prison abolition, abolition of policing, etc. But a lot of that work was really theoretical and making a case for the politics. And we were really interested in the how, right? And, you know, those questions come up. Oh, that's a great idea. How are you going to do that, right? And we knew from having done the work that lots of people are putting themselves to the how of this all day, every day, in lots and lots of places. And so we really wanted to amplify the how of the politics and honor the hard work that organizers do to make these politics real. So we, as Sheena mentioned, talked to people not all across Turtle Island. Let us not get too big for our britches here. We didn't talk to anybody in Mexico. But we talked to people in so-called Canada and so-called United States about how they do what they do, why they do what they do, how they're structured, what some of the challenges are, how they win or how they think about winning, and drew some of those lessons to think more broadly about, you know, what we could say about organizing for prison abolition. So there are a few things that we cover. We cover the book's kind of structured around these things that we call pathways. So there are five of them. This is where my notes, I left my notes elsewhere, but we wrote the book, so I should be able to do this, right? Okay. The five pathways are what we call anti-expansion, which is trying to prevent the construction of new prisons and jails and detention centers, and also trying to close them, decarceration and the closure and, I hope, demolition of these killing houses. Anti-expansion, legal advocacy, policy advocacy, prisoner solidarity, and art and culture. See, I got all five. I got them all. And so we thought of these not as the only or even the most important, but some of the main ways that we have experienced people moving this work forward. And then the rest of the book really is talking about the ins and outs of how everybody does these things. So as I said, there's like section on challenges and tensions and contradictions in our work. There's a section on winning. There's a section on movement building. There's a section on a chapter, I guess they call them in a book, on how organizations structure themselves and their work. And throughout, there are passages from the interviews that we did with some of the people in this very room. So lots of gratitude for anybody who talked to us for the book.
You're listening to the Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM, 91.7 on cable, and online at www.ckut.ca. We are airing audio from the Montreal book launch for the book How to Abolish Prisons, Lessons from the Movement Against Imprisonment by Justin Pichet and Rachel Herzing. Here we go.
What does the carceral landscape look like right now that you're documenting, resisting, and trying to eradicate? So we'll pass it over one at a time and then come back to me.
Hi, I'm Joanne Wendy Barito. I'm a member of a lot of stuff, so we're not going to go back into that. And there's a different ways that the landscape looks at right now. We're looking at expansion. We're looking at Ontario, but we're also looking at Quebec. They're rebuilding Tanguay with more beds now. So they're taking the women out of Leclerc and they're going to bring them back to a new Tanguay, which is a provincial prison system with extra beds, instead of trying to dim, you know. I like the saying, the movie, they build it, if you build it, they will come. Or if you build more beds, they're going to fill the beds and then, you know, put more people on the floor. Opposing that is a way of what the landscape looks like, the building and the opposing of it. I work mainly in federal institution designated for women. And we're talking about trying to reduce the amount of Indigenous women that are being incarcerated right now, 4% of the Canadian population, but 50% of the federal incarcerated women. So they make up half of the women in federal institution, which is horrible. And they're mostly over classified. So that means you mostly see them in maximum security, involuntary transferred, so away from the community. They spend more time in jail and it's harder to get released. So that is just increasing. I'm seeing a lot more commissioners, directors being changed. Their most recent one was about pen packs, which is the packages that you're being allowed to send. So they're restricting the amount of stuff that you can actually get. And they're actually investigating more, meaning like who you're getting your stuff from, how are you getting your stuff. So imposing more restrictions on there. Less people are in, less community is going in. So they were supposed to increase that, but they haven't. So the landscape is getting harsher, even though it looks stable, it is not. It's insidious, so they're not changing big things. They're just changing little things. That's my view, just adding prison policies to some things. So just slowly changing little things to make it more restrictive. And harder for people inside. So that's what I'm seeing right now with the landscape.
Hi, thank you so much for having us here. So we've got a little bit of a different perspective, I think, on the prison system than some of the others here. Our work is not extremely local, like a lot of the others. The framework of our project is Canada and the US. So we've got members spread across whatever it is, 60 different prison systems. So we don't have the deep knowledge of how one prison system works, but sort of a shallower knowledge across many, many different prison systems. But the one real big change that we've been grappling with over the last couple of years is the shift that we're seeing in a lot of the American jurisdictions. Because our project is primarily male-based, the shift that we're seeing in a lot of American jurisdictions where instead of allowing letters into prisons, they have to be sent to a central processing facility. They're then scanned. And in some cases, then people inside receive a photocopy. Sometimes they receive an image on a tablet that they're permitted to rent from the institution. And I mean, it's terrible in a lot of ways, right? It's terrible if your child draws you a picture and you then receive a scan of that picture. You're not able to hold it. You're not able to touch it. And it also increases a lot of the prospects of censorship. I mean, we know in general that rules in prison are applied in arbitrary ways. And the more rules being added around how mail is received, how mail is processed, just really exponentially increases the arbitrary nature of how it can be abused.
Yeah, and I feel like something else too, because we've both been involved with this project for a long time, it's like we see waves of gangs and backlash. So, I mean, like during 2020, when defund and abolition was so mainstream, we had this surge of interest in people wanting to be involved. And that's since, you know, we see a backlash through that. And so that's something that's also like reduced.
The Termite Collective has seen a lot of different things going on lately. One of the things in the prison system in Canada that we're seeing, the restrictions that were placed during COVID have not been lifted. You know, they put restrictions on when you could go to the gym and all that kind of stuff. And a lot of the institutions aren't backing off from that. They use that to change the rules within the institution. The Termite Collective is an abolitionist group, but and every opportunity we get, we work on abolition issues. But we also, at the same time, work on bettering the conditions for inmates and released inmates. The Termite Collective has inmates that are on the street, ex-inmates. I don't know if inmates is the right word to use, but people that had done time in prison, some done, who have done quite a bit of time in prison. And now with some of the prisoners I've talked to that are still inside, they're getting nervous because soon there's going to be a federal election. And they're petrified of a new conservative government getting in power, because the memory is still recent of all the cuts that the Harper government did. And, you know, I think one of the focuses going forward for all the groups that are dealing with prison stuff is to get the message out that, hey, you know, the Liberal government's terrible that we have now, but a conservative government that wants to strip inmates of all their rights and privileges is going to be way worse.
All right, so things are looking up. Sorry, you gotta laugh sometimes, or you know, we can cry too later. All right, so we get a sense of how things are going, and it is a difficult time to be organizing around prisons. It seems like a lot of momentum that we had in the first wave of COVID, where there were a lot of imprisoned people who were getting diverted and decarcerated. The prison population at the provincial territorial level, where people are either awaiting their day in court or serving sentences of 2 years minus a day, nationally, it declined by one-fifth. And that happened in a matter of weeks. And a lot of organizing went into that. There was campaigns like Contain COVID, Not People, and a bunch of different work, including here locally by Anti-Carceral Group and other groups here that were pushing. And so there were some wins. But again, pandemic went on. Prisons started to fill back. We weren't able to defend those. And we have to use that as lessons to try and push again. I guess what we could turn our attention to now is hearing a bit more about what the primary focus of your work is. You've already gotten a bit into that, that you're part of, and how the work that you do with these groups advances prison abolition.
Okay. I'm usually ad lib, but as a representative of Joint Effort Collective, I'm going to read a brief statement, and it'll give us... I'll go back into detail more. So Joint Effort is a community group of incarcerated and formerly incarcerated individuals and their allies involved in mutual solidarity and aid within prison and ex-prisoner communities. It started in a subcommittee of the BC Federation of Women in 1979 and has been part of the social justice movement for decades. It is an independent group that doesn't accept church or state funding, or and we have limited resources. We count on funding from individuals. Joint effort is dedicated is a dedicated community group committed to providing essential support to current and formerly incarcerated individuals and their allies in various cities such as Vancouver, Edmonton, Kitchener, and Montreal. Our primary goal is fostering mutual solidarity and aid within the prison and ex-prisoner communities. We believe in collective strength. Diverse approach allows us to negotiate with authorities, bureaucratic systems, and work towards social justice movements. Our work supports visions of community without prisons, recalling those times aside from the reality recent past of when prison didn't exist. Our group aims to connect people in prison with various communities and organizations outside the prison walls. We provide diverse support to incarcerated individuals, including organizing discussion group, workshop, music, theater, and sports. We have also collaborated with inmate committees and Native sister support and activities. So the way we do that mostly is through support. We do some activism outright when the new reliability clearance came out, meaning there was a lot more scrutiny to get your clearance to get into a federal prison. We did boycott it. But we're talking about sometimes it's a knife with double edge, un couteau à deux tranchants. So the way we had grieved the system is we stopped asking for clearance, so we stopped going into the federal prisons. Mm-hmm. So it's and we advocated for it, we put a pressure, but the only problem with that also is that who paid for that is the women and gender diverse people within the federal system that we were no longer visiting, right? So sometimes it's a fine line between are we harming or helping the people, and if we don't do it, is it going to keep going? So it's kind of, so what we decided to do, we kind of split the group in two. We had the people not going and not doing the reliability clearance, and then we had the people saying, well, we're going to just keep on going because the people we work for need us, right? So our clients need us. The other way we work for abolition is reducing the amount of people within the carceral system and reducing the revolving door. So if we have less people going back into prison, so there's less numbers going in there, and then if we create community of carceral people, and they can help the people coming out, so that kind of supports the community, so we have less people serving more than one sentence. And that's by giving them community support when they're inside. We do pen packs, which is penitentiary packages, which provide them with personal clothing, which is good for self-esteem, cultural items. You know, some people don't, you know, people dress differently, and it's the sense of who they are and their personality. And walking around in institutional clothing for 2+ years is soul draining. It is soul draining. So we do that. I'm starting a new project. I'm starting a new project in Quebec, providing what I call correctional plan GLADU reports, meaning that we have a lot of involuntary transferred folks from Edmonton that come in, and during their sentences, they did not get a GLADU report, and I hope everybody, I'm not going to get into what it is, but they didn't, it's like a pre-sentencing report for First Nation people, and they didn't get one for whatever reason during the sentencing, and it's affecting the way they're going through the carceral system, and people don't fund that. So providing GLADU reports so we have a better reintegration, and that they have actually the programming that they need. Because I see a lot of folks, they're just in limbo. They're like, they're in Joliet, they don't speak English, just from Edmonton, their family, the community. They don't have the every activities, they don't have the healing circles, they have nothing. They're in limbo here. And with the correct information, then they could provide requests what they need, right? So, and then just access to community. I connect with elders to go in on a visit once a month, just to go visit people so they feel more at home and more connected to their community. And the more people are connected to the community, the better they do. So that's how we provided. We provided doing a service.
So the Prisoner Correspondence Project is operates, there's like three main components. So it's a pen pal project, a resource library, and a newsletter of inside submissions. And it has a membership in Canada and the US. And we say we're like a project that connects queer and trans people with similarly identified people on the outside, but actually, like something Josh has said once was I really liked is that, like, so a lot of our membership would not necessarily be like traditionally considered queer and trans on the outside. So it's like we're like open basically to like anyone who wants to be involved. So it's not so much that we like support queer and trans prisoners, but rather we provide queer and trans support to prisoners. And so, for example, our resource library has a lot of materials that are very difficult to get inside prison, like HIV, AIDS information, or the most popular category is SMUT. And so this is a project that, so these are the three components that have been happening for a long time. And there are outside volunteer collective members, as well as an inside collective of around like 15, 20 prisoners who read and respond to monthly meeting minutes and give directions to the project. So something we were talking about when we were preparing for this panel is, like, is the work of the project itself abolitionist? And, you know, or is it, I feel like from the start of the project, we've had this question of, like, are we moving towards a world without prisons, or are we just creating, like, bigger cages and longer chains and, like, making life inside easier to tolerate? And that's something I feel like we've never resolved. But I do think that, you know, something you said, I feel like it's kind of awkward that we're sharing the mic, but so I'll just refer to things you've said. So something Josh was saying was like, you know, the project works within a larger context of an abolitionist movement, even if the work itself of like linking up individuals has like more of a personal impact rather than a widespread impact. And we also have about like 4,000 inside members across the US and Canada, mostly the US. There's only like 70 members in Canada, I think. And I think there are still ways that the project contributes to an abolitionist movement. So, I mean, first of all, it response to the main logic of the prison system, which is isolating people, removing certain people from the social context in the name of safety, and I mean what Ruth Gilmore calls a geographic solution to social problems. You like take these problematic people and put them somewhere else. And the project is a way of counteracting that partitioning by introducing people who would not normally come to contact with each other. And because people tend to support political advocacy when they have a personal stake, and we create these personal relationships that ends up building more of a coalition for the movement against prisons.
When we did that kind of reframing away from we're a solidarity project for LGBTQ prisoners to we provide LGBT support for prisoners, it also went, like, partially it was a shift because you saw with these efforts at reform that we're going to say, okay, prisons might be terrible for these people, but we're just going to go in and we're going to tweak this. And so conditions might be terrible for gay prisoners, but we're just going to give them their own unit and then things are going to be okay. And so we did this shift to really try to draw attention to the fact that the issues that gay and queer and trans prisoners face are not a discrete and separate set of issues. They are the same issues that all people in prison face. And so, yes, you may be isolated from your family, but that is just, that's the same issue. Like, everyone in prison is isolated from their family, right? You may just feel it in a particularly acute way. Or there may be, you may have difficulty accessing gender-affirming care, but that is one element of the medical neglect that everyone in prison is facing. And so, as Chris was saying, to really shifting that to really forward, this is part of a coalition against prisoners, or against prisons. It's not about elevating a specific subsect of prisoners.
That is something that really clarified for us, because there's been a huge backlash against trans prisoners like trans feminine prisoners inside women's prisons, and that's been like really prominent in Canada. And that's something we were like, how do we respond to this as like one of the main groups that works on LGBT prisoner issues? And we realized, you know, a lot of the rhetoric is like these trans women prisoners are a danger to the women inside. And I mean, it's like really bleak. So in the UK, the movement is called Keep Prison Single Sex, which I'm just like, oh, that's like the least inspiring name I've ever heard. But yeah, and we like kind of were like, how do we actually formulate a framework to talk about this that's not just like, that actually is abolitionist? And we had this call and we just realized that it's like, if we're going to talk about dangers to women prisoners, like, it's trans women are not it. Like, whether or not there's like sensationalist cases of individuals doing whatever, it's like prisons and like guards are like, if the people actually cared about the safety of women prisoners, this is not what they would focus on.
Hi, the Termite Collective is we focus on education. We do workshops, we speak, we do what we did today at the event here today. And that's the way we promote abolition. Basically educating, getting the message out. Because the prisons are hidden in Canada. You might drive by, you know, there's two of them in Laval. You might drive by, but, you know, nobody ever goes into them, or very few people go in. Termite Collective has a sister organization that goes into the prisons every week and has group meetings, puts on workshop work. There was a workshop in one of the prisons yesterday. And that's the way, by education. And I think that's the way going forward that we bring about prison abolition, is by getting the public involved, by letting the public know what they're sponsoring, you know, and what they're paying for. They're paying a huge amount of money for these prisons. If you close these prisons, you could solve most of the societal financial problems, you know, in a single stroke. But we do it through education, and we could do better at it, and I hope during the future we do a lot more of it. We're doing a lot of stuff around Concordia University, because that's where most of our members are, around that area. And it's when we do the events are very well attended, and a lot of times it's Concordia students or community members, and they get a lot out of it, and you get a lot of feedback later. They form an interest in what's being done in their name. Because believe it or not, prison system is working in your name. Because every time a prisoner steps up his head and wants something, oh, the public doesn't want you to have that. The public doesn't think you should have that. You know, and so they're doing this stuff in your name. So abolition has to come from the public. You know, the government's not going to do this willingly, and I think the only way forward is through education.
You're still listening to the Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM, 91.7 on cable, and online at www.ckut.ca. We are currently sharing audio from the Montreal book launch for the book How to Abolish Prisons: Lessons from the Movement Against Imprisonment. The book is by Justin Pichet and Rachel Herzing, and the book launch happened in Montreal on Saturday, May 4th.
That's great. Thank you. Thank you so much for sharing your insights in terms of the struggles that you're waging collectively and individually. So I do want to ask a question to Rachel in relation to some of the work that you do and how it connects with abolitionist struggles. It wasn't an accident in terms of who we have speaking here tonight and the groups that they're part of. In the book, as Rachel already mentioned, we do discuss five pathways to work towards abolitionism. Again, it's not all of them, but it's the ones that the groups that we spoke to talked about the most. One of those pathways is prisoner solidarity work. Okay, so this work involves placing the insights and organizing of imprisoned people at the center of your work. And I think that's something that, whether you're talking about joint effort, Prisoner Correspondence Project, Termite Collective, you're in that part of the chapter and in relation to those comments with prisoner solidarity work throughout the book. So I guess what I'd like to ask Rachel, and if any of you want to add anything onto this, is why is prisoner solidarity work, which we could also understand as mutual aid, important behind and beyond walls? And how is this work contributing to abolitionism?
Well, I think about mutual aid in a fairly specific way. And I think about it as a bit horizontal, right? So I'm helping somebody who's in a similar situation as I am get what they need to do what they need to do, and they're reciprocating with in kind. And that strikes me as a little bit different from maybe direct service or other kinds of things. And so I'm going to speak from that perspective, and maybe if other people have different ways of thinking about it, you can say your piece too. But particularly, I'm thinking about mutual aid inside of locked situations, right? So in prisons and jails and detention centers, the kind of support that imprisoned people give each other. And I think it's crucially important. And, you know, probably those of you who have done time can speak to this much more beautifully than I can. But people are helping each other all day, every day. And I appreciated the last comments that you made, Wendy, because there's this idea that imprisoned people, formerly imprisoned people, somehow stop being human beings, right? And so human beings need and like to help each other, right? We are social animals in that way. And we really benefit from being in relationship to each other. And so, of course, people inside prisons and jails and detention centers will look out for each other and you know, share knowledge, experience, material things, right? Help people get settled. If you're lacking something, you know, to share what you have. It happens all the time, right? And I think it's crucially important in one way, because it just amplifies everybody's humanity, right? So being in these relationships amplifies all of our humanity and helps us recognize each other in that way. The activities of mutual aid also really help imprisoned people stay in their best fighting form. And we need imprisoned people in our fight. So I campaign. That's mostly what I do. And the input, the activity, the skills and knowledge and strategy of imprisoned organizers is essential to us getting it right inside and outside. And so we need imprisoned organizers to be in their absolute best fighting form. And so those kind of helps, the supports that mutual aid provides, are really, really crucially important. And then I think the last thing I would say is that it really helps know each other a little bit better. We can understand what the conditions are of our struggles a bit more. We can understand what each other's going through a bit more and understand in more sharp focus how to fight, because we understand what we're up against. Does anybody else want to add?
Yeah, I really appreciate that. And I think something I want to talk about is, in relation to that question, is that there's often a bit of a tension in our project in terms of abolition, because a lot of people inside don't explicitly hold abolitionist views, while also doing what you're saying, Rachel. And I think something that I've been thinking about for the last couple of years is one of our inside members, like, we would kind of getting to, like, is someone I've worked with very closely, and there has always been a tension in our relationship where she's like an anarchist and an abolitionist, and yet still, like, when I ask her, like, what is abolitionist politics to you, she would talk about like personal responsibility, and she would be really like upset at other people for like doing drugs in prison. And I would always be like, what about the structures? And I think something she said that was really like illuminating to me, she's just like, I've been in prison since I was 18. Like, if I'm going to talk about how to change society, like, I don't really know, but I do know how to like be in the best position to fight. And I think that's something I've been thinking about in relation to, like, I've seen a shift in our understandings of prison abolition in the last decade, where it's become kind of a redistributionist politics, where it's like defund police and prisons and move the funds towards, you know, life-affirming resources. And I think just this person's question to me makes me think about, like, that shift, while I think is great, it also risks like leaving prisoners out of the fight, because, you know, like these policy fights, like this person has said, like, she's like, how do I have access to like do any of this? And I think that's something I grapple with and I don't have like an answer to, but I think that's where, you know, doing this kind of direct support is really important, because we don't lose sight of like the most impacted people while we're like doing these like big advocacy fights, which I think are really important.
Abolition in prison. I will speak for myself and my experience. There isn't abolition in prison other than a few that have voices and are loud and clear, and we pay for it. I had to transfer all the way out to the West Coast to be able to leave prison because my PO was just going to keep me there forever. I was going to die there, an old lady. So I had to do something and get out, and that's what happens when you have a voice. And the information is not inside. A lot of the articles and the prison journals that we used to get the information have been banned or are no longer allowed inside. So you don't get the information on abolition. I mean, you hardly get the information on your rights, you know, what your rights are. So, and then the other part is you're surviving prison. And being in prison is just surviving prison. You're not at, what do they call it, les résidences Joliette there, where everything is supplied for you. You're thinking at Beach de Joliette, but no, you're surviving. I mean, you're woken up every hour at night to make sure you're breathing. I'm like, fuck, if I'm dead, I'm dead. Leave me dead, right? I mean, you do that for every other break, but so you're surviving prison. So you're not thinking of abolition. The prison system took community out of the prisons. So you don't get a lot of people coming in and talking about it. Right? So you just got people around you, so you don't get the information. And so you're just, you know, that's what you do. You just survive, you do your thing, you try to live, and then you find out when you get out. Which is like, really? I could have done that inside? That's what I'm like. So, yeah. So it's hard to get, sometimes it's hard to get people inside to do it because repercussions, right? If you have two kids waiting for you outside, and a lot of the answers I got when I say, well, do a complaint or, you know, do something, it's like, I need to get out to my kids. If I do that, I'm not going to be recommended for the board. I'm not going to get out. So I just want to, so the abolition inside is squashed by the authorities. So it's hard, right? But it needs to get through. Right, it needs, so some organization like EFRI will go in and do advocacy. They'll do human rights training. So they'll teach people that they have rights and how to use them. And then they give the power back into their hands. And it's like you use it or you don't use it. It's up to you, but you have the information. So little things like that can be done. It's just passing the information.
All right, thanks for that. I want to ask Rachel, why should people get the book?
That sounded so conspiratorial. I think you should get the book because I think it's a good book. I think it is hopeful. I think it's practical. And I think it's concrete. And I think these are some of the criticisms that we hear sometimes about these politics, is that, you know, it's all up in the air, it's utopian, it's, you know, not real. And I think the book demonstrates just how real it is, you know, by talking to people like Josh, like, how do you do this, right? Or talking to people like Sheena or Donnie, how do you do this? And really making the concrete steps within everybody's grasp. so everybody could do something. And I think the book is not a blueprint. The title is a little bit of a wrong turn there, but it's not going to tell you step one, step two, step three. But I think there's a lot of stuff in there that if you put it together, you could figure out how to launch a campaign or engage in a project or take acts of solidarity that could chip away at the system until it is completely obsolete, which is the goal. So I hope people will read it. I hope people will use it. I think that's why.
Thanks for that, Rachel. And yeah, we when we wrote the book, we definitely wanted it to be useful. And so hopefully it is. So, you know, we've had a conversation about what the carceral landscape looks like that we're organizing in and against. We've talked about some of the work that each of your groups do and how that contributes towards abolitionist futures, prison abolition. So I'll leave you with just an opportunity to say a final word in terms of what you're going to be taking away from this discussion tonight forward with you in the fight to abolish imprisonment. And so I'll pass it to you first. Thanks, Tony.
I'm going to change up your question just a little bit because, you know, I'm a contrary person. What I want you guys to take away from this, I've been fighting with prison issues for 50 some years. And when I first became active doing that, it was to better the conditions inside prisons, to make changes where prisoners' rights got respected, where health care was better. And, you know, it's like banging your head against the wall. The system doesn't change. The only hope is abolishing the system. And that's what I hope you guys realize leaving here tonight, that, you know, it's fine, you know, all the groups that are right now trying to better conditions, we still have to do that. But the end result, the system's unchangeable. You know, any step forward you make, like they were supposedly, the Supreme Court told them to get rid of segregation. Well, Corrections Canada and the government of Canada just relabeled it. It's not segregation anymore. It's they keep changing the name because the courts told them to get rid of segregation. So if you don't have segregation, intervention unit, another name for what we used to call the whole. But change has to be fundamental, and we have to get rid of this system from the courts on through and how policing is done. You know, reforming it isn't going to work because the system has shown this time and time again. I'm involved with Prisoners' Justice Day. The same things that made Prisoners' Justice Day come about are still going on in the same prison. Guys are still dying there in segregation, being ignored. You know, so, you know, that's 50 years ago. You know, if they've shown a clear unwillingness, the public has to step up and say, hey, we don't want this anymore. And there's lots of ways for them to do that. You know, put caps on the amount of prisoners that are allowed to be held in custody. You know, force the programs to be there to stop people from going to prison. You know, all these things. But the only hope for the future is to abolish prisons.
And I think on that note, I want to say the system is intransigent, but it's also not inevitable. I mean, in Canada, I think because so much of the information about prisons comes from the US, like where you have like 2 million people inside and it's like so paralyzing. Like in Canada, there are like 700 people inside federal women's prisons. We just have to like change the lives of 700 people to abolish an entire wing of the prison system. And in the 90s, it was like 150, but then they built these like gender responsive regional prisons. And you know, so And in the provincial system, which is where most people are in prison, the average length of stay is like 40 days. Like, it's actually possible. And that's all I have to say.
I'm not going to give a grand statement. I'm just going to give a plug. that if you want to find out more about Prisoner Correspondence Project, the website is prisonercorrespondenceproject.com. And we have volunteer sessions every Tuesday from 5 till 8 at QBER Concordia.
I work for a Canadian Association for Elizabeth Fry Society for 4 years, and they're big on advocacy and trying to change policies, and it is beating my head against a wall, and it's so tiring and emotionally draining, and this is one of the reasons why I turned to service, because I was tired of doing 10 step forward and, you know, 20 back. And I wanted to see results, concrete results, right? So when I provide, like I just provided a baby pack. There's going to be a newborn in Joliet in June. And a mother child doesn't provide anything that leaves the establishment. So you get the crib and you get the toys if you don't leave with them. But you don't get the diapers. You sanitary napkins for her after birth, they don't supply. So I got a month's worth of diapers and wipes and little baby clothes and little slippers. And like all the stuff, like a baby, because if we didn't do that, she would have no possibility of keeping a newborn with her, right? So that's a small step, right? The baby's not going to be traumatized. Separation is just going to be, so for me, that's a small step. And that's something everybody can do, right? Funding is huge. Like these pen packs, these baby packs, they come from donations from people like you, right? So those things coming in, they're going back to them. It's uplifting. Campaigns. And time, donate time. Like I've been looking for a volunteer for Kitchener for the pen packs. A pen pack is, okay, I'll explain what a pen pack is because I've been talking about pen packs. Do you mind? It's quick. So a pen pack is either your first 30 days in federal incarceration, you can get clothing or like a TV or radio, but you have 30 days from your date of incarceration in federal. Some people don't have the money. Some people don't have the resources to get them. So they end up, whatever the time is, with institutional clothing, and that's it. So we provide, when the funds are available, these pen packs to people coming in, or lifer packs, meaning if you have a sentence more than 10 years, every 5 years you can switch clothes, okay, and baby packs and stuff like that. So it's very needed. So that's what a pen pack is. So my takeaway from this is every seat is filled. So there's an interest in, 30 seats here? So get involved any which way you want. Either donate, volunteer, spread the word. Like, have a dinner party about abolition, right? That'll be your dinner party subjects. So, and invite people that have no clue what abolition is about and just talk about it, right? So maybe two people they'll take away from your party. And then they'll have another party. It's spreading the word. The more people understand what incarceration is, the more abolitionists. And people that understand what abolition is all about. And it's not like, oh, my God, we're letting go all the criminals. They're all going to be romping around the street, right? Because when you say abolition, people, that's what they think. So education through a fun way.
I'm just going to steal from all of you. I think that my takeaway is that we are the ones, right? There is no, I say this all the time, I'm a broken record on it because I think it's true. There is no angel of abolition that will come down from on high, wave a magic wand, and presto chango, no prisons, no cops, no surveillance, no courts, right? We have to make that. And I think it is possible to make that happen. I agree with you, Chris. I think it doesn't change unless we break it apart, make a change. But we can do that. We have the power to do that. And if you believe in life, if you believe in the well-being of human beings, if you believe in a healthy, well society, we have to abolish prisons.
Thank you, Rachel. And I'll just very quickly say we have to organize, right? The state's not going to give us that. We have to build that ourselves. And if we are able to take away these harms and these conflicts that have been stolen by the prison industrial complex, by cops, courts, and cages, if we are able to build infrastructure to deal with that shit, then maybe we can get to prison abolition one day. Okay, and that's on us.
That was audio from the Montreal book launch of the book How to Abolish Prisons, Lessons from the Movement Against...
90.3 FM Montreal. You're listening to CKUT.
What's up, good people? To those of you listening wherever, whenever, whatever time it is, good morning, good evening, and good night. You are locked into another Tuesday evening with Soul Perspectives right here on CKUT 90.3 FM. Soul P has been on the air since 1994. We bring you all the topics, the guests, the ups and downs, the highs and the lows of the black community here in Montreal, across Canada, and internationally. I'm your host for the evening, Kim Dominique Ferguson, and we have a beautiful evening of music and discussion lined up for you tonight. Keep it locked. You are listening to Soul Perspectives right here on CKUT 90.3 on your FM dial.